Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in History, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Zeb Larson, and I'm here today with Dr. Michael Fischbach to discuss his new book, The Movement in the Middle East, A History of the Arab-Israeli Conflict Over Palestine. Dr. Fischbach shows how the conflict split the American left beginning in the 1960s and how that conflict is spilling over into the political mainstream today. Dr. Fischbach, welcome back to the New Books Network. Tell us a little bit about yourself, people who didn't have a chance to listen to your previous interview.
Sure. Well, for nearly 28 years, I've been a professor of history at Randolph-Macon College in Central Virginia. I did my graduate training at Georgetown University in modern Middle Eastern history, a subfield in modern European history. And most of my professional writing until recent years focused on property, land and property issues in the modern Middle East, mostly related to the Arab-Israeli conflict, that is Palestinian refugee property losses in 1948, the land and property left behind by Palestinian refugees. I also looked at a similar issue of Jewish property claims against Arab countries for land and property left behind there. But in the past 9 or so years, I've been focused on this very large project that took me in a very different direction. That is to focus on how the Arab-Israeli conflict factored into both the Black freedom struggle in America in the 1960s, as well as how the American left grappled with the Arab-Israeli conflict. And in both cases, looking at the various splits, some of them quite deep, in those forces as they approached the question very differently. And both some in the Black freedom struggle, for instance, civil rights leaders, supporting Israel, the Black Power movement, by contrast, largely supporting the Palestinians, and a similar process in the left, the new left, the old left, the anti-war movement, the women's movement. I mean, left, broadly speaking, was bitterly divided on this issue, despite its unanimity on virtually all the other major issues of the day. It was conceived and researched as one huge project, but it was simply too large for my publisher, Stanford University Press, and so it ended up, frankly, as two different books. In retrospect, sometimes I wonder about separating them quite so rigidly, but that's how it turned out.
So how does it build off of the book I interviewed you about last year, which was Black Power in Palestine, focusing sort of on that Black freedom struggle you describe?
Well, the first major expressions of pro-Palestinian support, that is, most Americans solidly supported Israel, in fact, 95%, according to polls right after the 1967 war. And so the first time most Americans had heard of criticisms, particularly withering criticisms of Israel for having launched the war in 67, general Israeli policy toward the Palestinians, came from Black Power radicals. And it was quickly picked up by particularly the new left, the youthful new left, and also by old left political parties. Now, by old left, I'm talking about left-wing parties from the early part of the 20th century, the Communist Party USA, later on Socialist Workers Party, the Socialist Party of America, other group, you know, Marxist and Trotsky, Leninist, Marxist-Leninist, Trotskyist, other left-wing social democratic parties from much, much earlier in the 20th century. And so fairly quickly after 67, black radicals having paved the way, you saw within the white left a lively and sometimes vicious debate about what to do with Israel. Is it somehow exempt from our overall anti-imperialist critiques of big power involvement in the Third World, or is it somehow exempt? And the fact that there was a high percentage of Jews in the left, both the old left, the new left, the anti-war movement, as well as on broader liberal society, only made these kind of conflicts worse. So this book follows on the heels of the first one in that the Black Power movement was really the first to begin introducing this new dialogue about the Middle East that spoke of imperialism and Third World liberation, and then the white left kept up on it. So that's how the two books are related.
So you sort of begin the book by looking at student groups. When did American student groups, you know, campus organizations and such, really begin paying attention to Israel and Palestine? And what was the effect on leftist youth groups?
Well, there had been, certainly within the old left, and part of it, again, stems from the high percentage of Jews. I mean, theoretical debates among socialists, Marxists, and others over the so-called Jewish question. And is Zionism an appropriate response, or is a working class socialist revolution the response? Those go back a long time. Certainly there were very big discussions in the 30s and the 40s. But as far as the period of the 1960s, there might have been occasional interest shown in it, but largely it was the June 1967 war that really precipitated things. Because that's when the question of Israel, the Arabs, the Palestinians really rocketed its way into America's consciousness, despite being busy with things like inner city black rebellions in the summer of 67, focusing on the space race, a war in Vietnam. This still got into the headlines, and that really forced, in some ways, student groups to begin grappling with how are we supposed to understand this? Our own country is escalating the war in Vietnam, using American planes to drop napalm on people of color in Southeast Asia, and here an American ally using American planes is dropping napalm on Arab peoples of color. And how are we supposed to understand that? Is it comparable? Should we oppose it? And so you found, even before the war broke out in the tense months of mid and late May 1967, for instance, at University of California at Berkeley, competing demonstrations by Arab students supporting the Arabs in what looked like a coming war, and later it was a war. And you had some a youth group associated with the Socialist Party USA arguing very much the opposite. Israel is a socialist state surrounded by totalitarian governments backed by the Soviet Union and is eminently worthy of our support. So even in the days prior to the June War, which started on June 5th, 1967, you saw some student groups on particularly politically oriented campuses like Berkeley already speaking out. But it largely on campuses was 1969 that you really saw an upswing in teach-ins and pro-Israeli, pro-Palestinian debates. Because by that time, Israel's occupation was lasting into 2 years, occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. By that time, Palestinian guerrilla groups consolidating into the PLO were really in the global headlines. And so some of these campus pro and anti activities actually descended into fistfights, and the police were called in on at least one major occasion at Columbia. So that's really when the student movement, both old left groups and new left groups, using the fora of campus protests, of teach-ins, things that were already going on about other issues, began using those same kinds of fora to debate positions on the Middle East.
Now, how did the old left react to the Israel-Palestine issue, and where do we see evolution in that? I mean, as you've alluded, those discussions begin before June of 1967.
Yes, very much so. The Communist Party USA and its big rivals, the Trotskyists in the Socialist Workers Party, on the one hand, and Social Democrats in the Socialist Party of America, on the other hand. There was bitter rivalry between the Stalinists and the Trotskyists, the Stalinists and the Social Democrats going way back. And there had been discussion on that. And I think it's fair to say that by and large, the old left was fairly hostile, openly hostile to Zionism. Now, the Holocaust, the establishment of Israel in 1948 changed some of that. But certainly there was a legacy of an inherent at best, a suspicion of Zionism. So when the war happened, old left groups, the Socialist Workers Party, immediately denounced Israel for having started the war. The Workers' World Party, which is another Marxist group that emerged out of the SWP. In fact, they carried out the only known demonstrations against Israel to actually take place during the 6 days of the war. The Socialists initially were following the Socialist International, called on kind of both sides to exercise restraint. But the Communist Party USA almost immediately faced splits. The party leadership, following the Soviet Party's line, condemned Israel as the aggressor for having started the war. The party always said Israel exists and must maintain its existence. No one's talking about dismantling Israel, but Israel was the aggressor. And there was a rebellion of sorts among Jewish, particularly Jewish comrades within the Communist Party, some of whom described themselves as pro-Israel but non-Zionist. And the FBI, which had, by its claim, literally hundreds of informants, fueled this kind of division within the party, and in a document described it as a crisis of the first order of magnitude that was really ripping apart the Communist Party. So the old left, by and large, was quite critical of Israel, and this is reflected in various journals that came out at the time, for instance, but National Guardian, for example. But it wasn't unanimous. Certainly the Communist Party was split. And by 1970, the Socialist Party of America had drifted quite strongly into a pro-Israeli position, quite stridently so. So there was far from unanimity, and sometimes these disputes mirrored earlier disputes. I mean, it's not a surprise that the Communist Party came out strongly against Israel, despite the objection of its members, some of them, and that the Socialist Party of America would take the exact opposite position. I mean, that reflects the fact that those two groups had been at each other's throats for decades. So the old left took various positions on it.
Now, I wanted to spend a little more time on the socialist groups, because I think there's a really interesting bifurcation that happens here. It seems that the communist, explicitly sort of Marxist groups in the American left ultimately drift towards a pro-Palestinian position against the objection of some of their members, but that happens. Socialist groups go in a different trajectory. And beyond the fact that they were opposed to the Communist Party of the USA, just sort of intrinsically, what makes that happen?
I think there were a couple factors beyond the one you just mentioned. A second one is there was a strong level of support for Israel among Jewish comrades within they wouldn't want me calling them comrades, but party members in the Socialist Party. Not exclusively. Michael Harrington was an Irish-American Catholic, and he was strongly supportive of Israel. But like other left-wing parties, there was a warm spot in some party members' hearts, precisely because they were Jewish. I mean, in many ways, that was understandable, even though others, some of the most vociferous critics of Israel on the left, were themselves Jewish. That's one. Number two, the socialists had absorbed, in part, through a theoretician named Max Schachtman, but others had absorbed a Cold War mentality about the Soviet Union. They were intrinsically opposed to the CP and to the Soviet Union. And their bitterness extended into a wider concern about, again, a kind of a Cold War concern, that anything the Soviets or the communists touched was innately part of a threat to not just, you know, America, but to socialists too. So they were quite vociferous in saying that, well, it's the Soviet Union supporting the Arabs, and the Soviet Union is a totalitarian government. It is not encouraged democracy, let alone social democracy or democratic socialism, however you want to look at it. And indeed, so hostile were the likes in the Socialist Party of Carl Gershman, who at that time was a young man, Bayard Rustin. You could think of others. I could go down the list. A. Philip Randolph, Michael Harrington. So fearful of Soviet communism and its impact on democratic movements and on workers, you know, workers' movements, that was another factor driving their into the arms of Israel. And the socialists said, look, Israel is a social democratic state. It has a strong workers' movement, and it is a bulwark against, you know, Soviet expansionism in the Middle East. So that was another important factor in explaining the socialists' open embrace of Israel, and the fact that eventually many of them deserted the left and provided some of the nucleus of the neoconservative movement had something to do with this very process about the left's stance on Israel.
And I would love to come back to that point a little bit towards the end, because I think that is really one of the more compelling arguments you see play out here. But I wanted to shift for a bit to look at peace activists, sort of explicit pacifist types. In the wake of Vietnam, how did they approach the issue of Israel and Palestine? Because it seems to me that there's a shift that comes after about 1973.
Yes. Your question, you want to talk just about the pacifists for now?
Just for now, and then okay. Sort of where their thinking goes after like the mid-70s, let's say.
Sure. Religious pacifists like the Quakers, the American Friends Service Committee, actually began investigating the Middle East in 1968 and issued a report in 1970. There were efforts also in 1970 by the same group, AFSC, working with another religious-oriented pacifist group called the Fellowship of Reconciliation to try to bring some speakers, some Israeli peaceniks to the United States. That really blew up, and there was a lot of controversy. Similarly, the Fellowship of Reconciliation tried to work with a Jewish pacifist group called the Jewish Peace Fellowship to bring over yet another kind of Israeli nonconformist and peacenik. The two men were Uri Avneri and Uri Davis. And both of those trips fell apart by late 1970. There was just too much controversy. The most outspoken religious pacifist who then emerged on the scene was the Jesuit priest Daniel Berrigan, who was famous for, among other things, you know, burning draft files at Catonsville, Maryland with homemade napalm. And he, after the October 1973 war, so you're right, this is really, Vietnam was essentially over by then, at least as far as American involvement. And he made this strident statement in the midst of the October 73 war, denouncing the Arabs, denouncing the Israelis. And in his speech, he kind of foretold what was to happen. He said, look, if I look like I'm attacking Israel more stridently than the Arab states, it's because of, you know, my own government's involved. And he listed several other things. And indeed, it all blew up. He was denounced as an anti-Semite. People who had been involved with him, Rabbi Balfour Brickman, for instance, in anti-war movements in the late 60s, distanced themselves from Berrigan. So, you know, the religious pacifists certainly took pains to, in their own way, address the issue, but they too faced controversy. The secular pacifists, the main group involved in this kind of work, similarly waited until the early 70s, and that was the War Resisters League, the nation's oldest secular pacifist organization. And figures like David McReynolds, who was also in the Socialist Party of America, people such as Jim Peck were pushing that they supported neither side. As pacifists, they said, we support neither side's military actions. We don't support American arms shipments to anybody in the Middle East. And finally, in part because of the recent, this new war, October 1973, and in part because of the Berrigan issue, the War Resisters League finally, in 1974, decided that we really need to make a statement about the Arab-Israeli conflict and war in the Middle East. And they finally got around to doing so, and they published it and distributed it widely. So really, the pacifist group's hesitancy to some of the backfiring that they got when they tried to address this is one reason I think that left them determining what to do in the late 60s, and it took them until the early 70s to really say, okay, we are going to speak out on this issue. And I think the fact that the anti-war movement in general was now dissipating gave them an opening to talk about things other than Vietnam, because that war, at least for America, had essentially come to an end. So that's the pacifists' approach within the anti-war movement. It was a touchy subject, and by and large, progress was made in terms of issuing reports and statements. It waited until the early 70s.
So before sort of continuing on chronologically, I was curious, you mentioned they bring over some Israeli peaceniks as speakers in this period. And this is one of those awful two-part questions. To what extent are groups on the left interacting with Israelis in this process? And to what extent are they interacting with Palestinians, especially maybe Palestinians living in the United States?
Well, those pacifist groups did. And a group that was, it actually originally emerged out of the Socialist Workers Party, but became very much associated with Noam Chomsky, a group called CONAM, Committee on New Alternatives in the Middle East, that emerged in 1970 and really ceased functioning not too long after that in 1974. And CONAM and Chomsky personally were committed to bringing alternative voices into the United States. And that included the first speaker they brought was someone from a radically anti-Zionist Marxist Israeli group called the Israeli Socialist Organization, or better known as Matzpen. And they brought him over, Aryeh Bobel was his name. And, you know, Chomsky wanted to bring particularly those kinds of voices, Israeli, Jewish, not exclusively, but that's many of the people they originally tried to get their voices to be heard in the United States, to show the left, to show the anti-war movement that there was not a unified consensus in Israel, let alone among American Jews, about this subject. There were other attempts, particularly among self-described Jewish radical groups, such as the Radical Zionist Alliance, the Jewish Liberation Project, groups that saw themselves as youthful advocates of socialism, even to some degree revolution, but they saw that as fully consistent with being Zionist, and they had much contact with Israel. In fact, within Israel, there was a group that emerged called the Israeli New Left, Smol Yisraeli Chadash, or Siach, it went by the Hebrew acronym Siach, that had a lot of cross-pollination, American Jewish New Leftists who went to Israel, either visiting or to live there, or live there for a summer, and there was a lot of cross-fertilization there. As far as people on the anti-war movement, or the left more broadly, interacting with Palestinians and Arabs, most of that occurred through the presence of Arab students in the United States already. There were trips. There indeed were trips white leftists took to the Middle East. People met Arafat. They went to conferences. But I think the highest degree of interaction between Arab students, for instance, and American students occurred on college campuses over here. Indeed, the Palestinians were aware of some black and white American support, but I think by and large, there was more exchange of ideas and people going back and forth as far as Israeli peaceniks and Israeli leftists than Palestinians from the Middle East traveling to the West to address crowds. There were plenty of academics, professors, students already here. So I think to the extent then that the left heard actual Palestinians speaking of them themselves and their issues, it was people who were already here.
Now, what's interesting in all of this, and you noted this at the beginning of this interview, is that there are a great many American Jews in the spectrum of leftist groups in this period, and there are pretty stark divisions that start to form. What do some of those disputes look like, and is there an organized place where you can see the fault line in American Jews? Is it generational? Does it sort of depend on which group they might be affiliated with in that moment?
You know, that's a good question, and well, certainly older American Jews, particularly of the Holocaust generation, were aghast that a country that they considered a symbol of Jewish Renaissance and as a safe haven, God forbid, in the case of a future Holocaust, would come under attack for a war that they saw as driven by self-defense, under attack by fellow Jews. I mean, that, and you had people, Seymour Martin, Lipset, Nathan Glazer, I mean, you know, older Jewish liberals and socialists and anti-war people just excoriating these people being self-hating. These attitudes stemmed from complexes they had with their parents and their upbringing and so on and so forth. So certainly older people felt that way, but even among liberal and left-wing Jewish youth, there was quite a lot of division. It wasn't simply those raised in a more religious environment versus those in a more secular. It seemed from my research and in interviewing many of these people and reading things they wrote that it ultimately was very personal. I mean, some people just immediately saw the connection between the Palestinian struggle, their own internationalist worldview, and it came to them very easily. Others had very agonizing discussions with themselves, their colleagues, their families. There didn't seem to be a common set of criteria from which I, as a researcher, could look and say, oh, well, this fits that mold. Secular upbringing, non-Zionist upbringing, didn't go to Jewish summer camps, et cetera, et cetera. I couldn't find any commonalities there. It really seemed like it was a personal decision. But as one person said, to be true to my left-wing convictions and my friends, I needed to go in an anti-Zionist direction. But I was very keenly aware that that was also driving me away from much of what I had been taught from many of my family members. And she said it was a very agonizing choice. So I couldn't find really a uniform set of criteria by which someone could say, yeah, that person was likely to be willing to criticize Israel more than this person was.
Interesting. So after 1973, where do we start to see the discussions going among leftist groups? Because it seems like this 67 to 73 period, there's a great deal of conflict. These groups are sort of trying to internally sort out their own positions. Where do we start to see the discussions going as we get into the 1970s?
Well, I am among those who think that the new left was, the new left was gone by, let's say, about 73. But that didn't mean the left ended. And certainly one of the manifestations of this was an above ground movement that some have described as the new communist movement, when certain ex-new left people said that, what we really need is a fairly ideologically sophisticated and hierarchical, vanguard Marxist-Leninist party that's going to lead a revolution. It can't just be sort of disparate actions carried out in a fit of emotion by the new left, and the new left is gone. What we need in the 70s now to bring about a revolution is, like I said, a vanguard party. And many of those, in fact, basically all of those, with partial exception of one group, adopted fairly stridently pro-Palestinian attitudes, attacks on Israel. This was the period where guerrilla wars were going on in Africa and elsewhere, and they saw them as fully part and parcel of this attempt to overthrow an imperialist system that undergirded capitalism. And for them, they carried on that ideological battle, even though these groups' memberships were very, very small. And I know some would say it panders to stereotypes, but they were at each other's throats, and who was more Marxist than the other, and who supported Mao, and who supported Enver Hoxha in Albania, and they didn't have a great weight in society. The left in general didn't. The other way that the left in the 70s, as the new left disappeared, carried on the tradition of particularly strongly pro-Palestinian attitudes were some of the underground groups that didn't go above ground at patient party building and working in factories and organizing workers, but groups like the Weather Underground, who came out of the Students for a Democratic Society, the main left-wing student group in the 60s. And in 1970, they went underground and said the way to continue the struggle to end the war in Vietnam and elsewhere to change American society is to, as they call it, declare war on the United States government. And they went around setting off bombs and things. And while they didn't carry out bombings or other concrete actions in support of the Palestinians, they discussed it and wrote in a manifesto they published in 1974 called Prairie Fire. They talked quite a bit about the Palestinian struggle. So new left willingness to criticize Israel and support the Palestinians definitely continued into the 70s, particularly with Marxist groups. But I hasten to add, at the same time, the social democratic left continued further and further into a pro-Israeli orbit, but not exclusively so. The Socialist Party split in December 1972. What emerged was something called Social Democrats USA, which are still around technically, and they were pretty stridently pro-Israeli. And indeed, kind of, you start merging into neoconservative stuff. Some of those people branched into neoconservatism. Another branch that was very supportive of Israel is today what we call the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America. But there was another social democratic group that in the 70s also, it came out of the new left, but that was called the New American Movement. And they were pretty strongly actually pro-Palestinian. And this created some real problems when the New American Movement and the predecessor to the Democratic Socialists of America decided to merge. And that was the main sticking point when those two groups merged, which they eventually did in 1980, was how do we approach Israel and Palestine? So by the time the new left is over and the old left is still around, but not nearly as influential, you still found these divisions going on in the left right through the 1970s.
Now, since you've brought up this sort of neoconservative turn we see in some of these social democratic groups, I was wondering if you could explain maybe for our listeners just a little bit what that means and then sort of what specific shape that took. You know, how did this experience of witnessing the Israel-Palestinian struggle lead to this sort of novel political worldview?
Right. Neoconservatives, by and large, and they were very influential in this country in the 2000s, particularly the George W. Bush administration, the decision to invade Iraq, and things like that, by and large were conservative in that they believed in the projection of American power, including military power, but broke with traditional conservatives who sometimes had kind of an America First policy in that they had, in a sense, a liberal underpinnings that we need to make good things happen in the world. We need to spread American democracy. We need to support democratic forms of capitalism, for instance, and to project American power not simply to preserve American interests, but also to better the world, almost a Wilsonian vision. So neoconservatives had a fairly militant foreign policy They embraced the Reagan administration's goals in the 1980s, particularly because they were incredibly hostile to the Soviet Union. And that goes back. Not all of them were members of the Socialist Party, but without exception, the neoconservatives believed in confronting the Soviet Union. They opposed the policy of détente under Henry Kissinger and President Nixon, President Carter's attempts to negotiate with the Soviet Union. They were very hardline. But they, again, also had a kind of liberal flair, almost like what we used to see in Vietnam, in that, well, we're helping people. We're bringing democracy. We want to make it better for them. And so that, in a sense, let's call it, if not left-wing, at least liberal background, coinciding with the traditional anti-Soviet, anti-communist views of the socialists, on one level made it natural for them to shift into neoconservatism. Notably, there were many factors, notably two. One, the Social Democrats really by the early 70s had decided that they needed to function not electorally in terms of running candidates, but really work within the Democratic Party, within labor unions, okay? Basically become the left flank of the Democratic Party. And when the Democratic Party nominated George McGovern in 72, this avowed peacenik, he talked about military cuts, that was a huge problem for the Social Democrats as far as we're going to work within the Democratic Party, but this guy is doing exactly the opposite of what we think ought to happen. That was one factor that kind of pushed them finally out of the Socialist Party and in many ways out of the Democratic Party and out of the left. The other factor, I think, was the 1973 Arab-Israeli War. The massive intervention of the Soviet Union in terms of sending supplies and things to the Arabs, and the Americans did the same to the Israelis, but that was an example to them of Soviet expansionism. And I think the third factor is that many, not all by any means, but many of the early leading lights in the neoconservative movement were also Jewish. I mean, Norman Podhoretz, sort of one of the godfathers, along with Irving Kristol, of the neoconservative movement, openly conceded that many of them were Jewish and were fed up with the hostile treatment of Israel on the left. They saw Israel, as I said earlier, as a bastion of progress against reactionary Arabs supported by Soviet totalitarianism, and that helped push them further away from the left. So I think there were a couple factors that explain the growth of neoconservatism, and not all of it, but much of it was rooted, in fact, in their disgust at the left's what they perceived as the left's overall hostility toward Israel in the late 60s.
So you end the book with an anecdote about this group that you just mentioned a few minutes ago, the Democratic Socialists of America. Fast forward to this moment in 2016 when DSA is undergoing its own tensions over Israel and Palestine. And I was wondering, maybe set up that anecdote for the listener, but also what's the long-term effect of this split over Israel and Palestine on the American left? How are we seeing it play out today?
Mm-hmm. Well, the anecdote was that there was again, when the Socialist Party of America split in 1972, the majority continued on with the name Social Democrats USA. There was a second split that ended up under David McReynolds forming a new party called the Socialist Party USA. And there was a third faction that called itself, with Michael Harrington and Irving Howe, that called itself the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee. That's the one that eventually merged with this other socialist group that I mentioned called the New American Movement. And they had quite a disagreement about how this unified party was going to deal with the Middle East. They had this long drawn out set of negotiations. And in 1980, that they did merge, and that became the DSA, Democratic Socialists of America. And a young member in the book, the anecdote you mentioned, a young member at the time of the DSA had been one of the vociferous opponents of merging the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee with the New American Movement, because he said the New American Movement, NAM's position is much too pro-Palestinian. That fellow later ended up moving to Israel, living most of his life in Israel, and then in Britain. And he rejoined and maybe the ascendance in American politics of Bernie Sanders had, maybe it had something to do with it. He rejoined, or let's say joined the DSA, the Unified DSA, in 2016, and resigned within a year out of anger because the DSA voted to on a platform that was fairly strongly pro-Palestinian. And he said, this is not what the left, this is not, socialists should support Israel. And it was, I think, a personal defeat to him, particularly because he had been among those in the early days saying that, you know, we need to be solidly pro-Israeli. But what it meant by 2017, by the present day, is that the DSA has aligned itself pretty firmly with the Palestinians. Most remaining social democratic groups have. That is, in our day and age, the left, what I would call sort of the true left, from the Marxist left to the democratic socialist left, is fairly unanimous now. If there were debates in the 60s, those are basically gone. We see solidly pro-Palestinian positions. Now, in the wider world, let's say not actual left, but liberals to progressives, this is still very much a live issue today. And that's where the DSA's inroads into the Democratic Party come into play. Not just the actual DSA members like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or the Palestinian-American Rashida Tlaib, but even people who aren't in the DSA like Bernie Sanders. The influence of socialists within the Democratic Party mirrors the fact that large chunks, particularly of the youthful rank and file of the Democratic Party, not act socialists, just regular Democratic Party, similarly, by opinion polls, have shown themselves to be much more sympathetic to Palestinians and to Israel. And so this is presenting the current Democratic Party leadership with a real problem. That whether you're talking about donors or whether you're talking about electoral support, that the fact that the traditionally democratic, solidly pro-Israeli Democratic Party and its party bosses are facing a kind of youthful revolt on a number of levels, not just those who support Palestine versus Israel, but on how the people within the party view capitalism, how they view socialism, that once again, like in the 60s, we see the Democratic Party, which I'm not calling left-wing, but let's say the Democrats, wider liberal and progressives, once again, like in the 60s, becoming very bitterly divided about Israel-Palestine in the midst of divisions that they're suffering anyway. And as they go into the November 2020 elections, this lack of unity over Israel-Palestine is only going to add to the fractiousness of the party over other questions, like I said, of socialism versus capitalism and Bernie versus others. And it can, unless they somehow figure out how to deal with this, it's going to lead to even further problems for them. And I think that's pretty clear. And I might add that worsening progressives who support Israel strongly but are still consider themselves progressives, worsening their troubles is the fact that the presidency of Donald Trump, that many, all progressives are working to defeat Trump, and even the pro-Israeli progressives are working to defeat Trump. Yet, ironically, Trump has been the most stridently pro-Israeli president we've seen in terms of actual decisions he's made. So supporting Israel, ironically, can be viewed as a default support for President Trump's policies, but at the same time, these activists don't want Trump reelected. So this, again, the question of Israel-Palestine is still bedeviling, if not the actual left in America today, which is pretty small, it is still bedeviling the wider progressive society. How do we fit this particular conflict into our overall worldview about American power, about imperialism, about justice, and so on and so forth? And I think it gets less coverage than the histrionics in the Democratic Party over capitalism versus socialism, you know, Bloomberg versus Sanders. But it's definitely there. It's not reported as much, but it's another real source of problem for the Democrats.
Now, I have just one more question for you. And this, I know that this project has been long in the making and involved a tremendous amount of research. What are you thinking of working on now?
Well, the honest answer is, I don't know. I remember once in between projects striking out in a certain direction, and someone who I think had a lot of wisdom said, you know, projects will find you. You can't really actively look for them. Something will happen and it'll grab you. And in that case, it was this very subject, the 60s and the Arab-Israeli conflict in America. So right now, I think I'm just kind of giving great wide berth to the muses and waiting for them to strike me with some new idea. Undoubtedly, it will deal with the Arab-Israeli conflict. That's really is my bailiwick. But I doubt it will involve America in the 60s again. But beyond that general issue of Israel and the Palestinians, at this point, I honestly couldn't say. So that's my honest answer to your question.
Well, I'll look forward to seeing where it takes you. Thank you again for coming on the program.
Zeb, it's been my pleasure as always, and I hope to talk to you again soon.